The Bernard Bergen Podcast is brought to you by BernardBergen.com. Visit for more on human performance insights and results coaching.
I am speaking with Naja Alessi, amazing content creator, amazing author, speaker, and someone who uses transparency to help people truly understand not only that they're not alone, but you're probably not the only one. As a mental health researcher, that journey into research started from her own story, and I will let her tell it best in her words as we do this two-part series. But what I want you to do is connect with Naja. She has a short film out there. We want you watching that film. We want you sharing that film, because in it, there is stories of overcoming some very relatable issues. Naja, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for having me on and being able to collaborate with me. This is such a blessing, being able to use my voice and my story to be able to help others. So I'm excited. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I am no stranger to pain, no stranger to depression and anxiety. I'm 34 years old now, and starting when I was 14 years old, I had a lot of issues growing up with my family, kind of had a very dysfunctional family. Parents got divorced and we were kind of all over the place. And so I was raped at the age of 15 and had a miscarriage from that rape, and had to go through a lot of different surgeries. After that, my self-worth obviously went down, and I ended up in two very abusive relationships. And one of those relationships resulted in my ex committing suicide. He was in a very dark place. And so those things I was able to kind of journey through with God. But the peak of my pain and depression really took off when in 2017, April 2017, my brother, who was my best friend, who I spent all my time with, we were two peas in a pod, he ended up taking his own life. And so that's kind of where my journey really started with depression and anxiety.
Wow. Thank you for being able to let us into your world. I know that isn't easy, but I know that when people hear this, they will know that they're not alone. And when you share that your brother and you were two peas in a pod, most people with siblings would say, yeah, I'm close to my sibling too. But at times you and your brother had the opportunity to live together. So again, even in your adulthood, you guys really had a deep bond. Tell us about your brother for a minute.
Yeah, we had a bond, I think, that people probably will never understand. A lot of my really close friends, you know, they knew how close we were. But other people were like, wow, like, I've never seen two siblings like this close before. He did live with me for several years. And there were times where I would come home from work, I would work long hours, and he would get off before me. And I would come into my room and he'd be in my bed with snacks watching a movie. And he just knew, like, I needed a moment. So he's like, I got the movie on that you wanted to watch. You know, I got snacks. Come on, come watch this with me. And I would hop in the bed with him and we'd watch movies and eat snacks and laugh and pass out and go to sleep. We would go camping together. He was the type of person that wanted to do just anything and everything. And I was kind of that weird, awkward person too, like, oh, let's go on an adventure. So we'd find random places to go camping. We went to Camp Cedar Falls one time, and there was this abandoned blue house in the middle of the woods. And we're like, let's pack a bunch of snacks and our blankets, and let's go stay in this blue house. Now, we're not kids, whereas we're adults. I'm telling you, we're adults when we went to go do this. But that's the kind of heart that we had. He was fearless. And I was not fearless, but I was always fearless when I was with him. So I remember when we got to Camp Cedar Falls, there was this bridge that was super high, and I never wanted to go across it when I was at camp before with the youth. But for some reason, when I was with him, I walked across it with no problem. And that's just the kind of spirit that he had. Like, you always felt safe and fearless with him. And we stayed in that blue house for two nights. We froze our butts off. And we would have stayed longer, but he ended up eating all of the snacks. So we ended up having to leave early. But but that was his spirit, man. He was just fearless, and he loved being around me. And the things that we like to do, a lot of other people were like, okay, you guys are crazy. I don't even know where you guys got this idea from. But it was me and him. We would go out to places and he would let me dress him. You know, I'm like, okay, I have a suit for you. You're going to put these pants on. You can wear my watch. And it was just that kind of a bond. We were close. We were just inseparable. And he came to me one day and he said, I think I'm going to move out on my own. I'm going to move to LA. And I remember bawling, crying that day, because I think my spirit knew that our bond was going to break a little bit when he left. I kind of knew, I don't know if, you know, if you've ever been to LA before, but it's a different city to live in. Yeah. And so when you go to LA and you don't know who you are, LA will tell you who you are. Mm. And so I kind of felt like when he went to LA that he still had a lot of growing to do, and he wasn't going to really be able to, you know, navigate it without me. Like, how are you leaving me? I'm your big sister. Like, and so I cried that day. And I think that was actually the beginning of my spirit mourning him. Because it was after that, that things just really took a turn in our relationship. And he started to hang out with the wrong crowd in Los Angeles. He got connected with this life group called Landmark. And they started to almost like brainwash him or teach him different things. And he was asking a lot of questions about God and about life. And I could just tell that his personality and his character was starting to change slowly. And it was just really sad because, you know, we were almost like twins, you know?
Yeah. Now, tell us about loving someone during their darkest moments. You know, here you are, his big sister. You love him. You're there for him. You're willing to share advice. You're willing to help him in any way. But at this point, you know, he's not looking for that. What did it feel like to you to love during that moment?
You know, for me personally, it was he taught me what unconditional love was. You know, outside of God, I had broken relationships with our parents. I had broken relationships with men. He was there every step of the way, every tear that fell. And so with him, it was unconditional. He could never do anything wrong enough for me to be upset. And so I remember when things started getting really dark for him and him starting to get really sick, I remember sitting in my car in my garage, and I just started crying out to God. And I said, God, whatever it is that he has, give to me, I'll take it. If you can allow him to just be healed, if you can just help him, whatever it is that he has that's making him sick, give it to me. I'll take it. I'll take it for him. And I remember just saying that over and over, like, I'll take it. And so I think, you know, the word says the greatest thing that you can ever do is lay down your life for your brother. And a lot of people may not ever know what that feels like, but if you have a child or someone that you love, you know that you would probably give your life for them. So when he was going through his darkest moments, it was extremely painful to watch him go from being vibrant and happy and encouraging. His name was Striver, and he had this slogan called Strive Harder. And every single person that he met, whether they were a homeless person or whoever, he would give him a wristband that said Strive Harder, and he would talk to them and have a conversation with them. And he would humanize them again if they didn't feel like a human. And he would say, you know, it's okay. You got to push past this. You know, you got to strive harder. And to see him go from that to giving up on himself was probably one of the most difficult things I've ever dealt with, because I couldn't take the pain away. At that time, I had no idea really what depression looked like. And so I knew this wasn't him. There were times where I would stare at him and his eyes would just be blank. And I just knew that all I can do is love you. That's it. There's nothing else that I can do. I can't take this away. I can't change it. I never knew exactly how he felt. We would have conversations and he would tell me that, you know, he felt empty and he felt like he didn't have a soul, sometimes he would say. And I remember, you know, months before this, he had gotten baptized. And so that was one of the things I was holding on to. Okay, he got baptized. He believes in Christ. I can talk to him about the Bible. And so we would talk about the Bible a lot. And I just tried to do anything that I could to try and counteract how he felt. You know, I would take him to a pastor and I would have him talk to this person and take him to my grandpa and take him. So it was just, you know, running around trying to figure out, you know, who can save him. And I had no resources. I had no idea like of where to go or what to do or anything. I just really had to watch him suffer. And it was probably one of the hardest things ever to watch somebody that you love suffer.
Wow. Again, thanks for being willing to share and not just glaze over it. I think in moments of sometimes the deepest despair, the lessons we take away can truly be a bridge to someone else. And I think your journey to date really showcases that. And, you know, I want to shift the conversation, but just slightly to, you know, just talk about your upcoming book, Pain Not Wasted, you know, which ultimately documents in detail a lot of what we're talking about today and in this two-part series. And, you know, I kind of want to just ask why the title Pain Not Wasted.
Oh man, this title means so much to me, honestly. I was sitting in my room. I'm a documentary buff and I love watching documentaries, especially on health and wellness and crime shows. But I was watching this one documentary and it was about a little girl who had this disease where she felt no pain. And I thought, wow, this is an amazing disease. Like, I would love to have this. And so I'm watching further in the documentary and her parents come on the screen and they're crying and they're saying, oh my gosh, we're praying that one day my daughter can feel pain. And I'm like, why would you want your daughter to feel pain? This is amazing. She can go to the dentist and she can play sports and she's not going to feel anything. This is awesome. And then the doctor comes on the screen and he's saying, you know, this is probably one of the worst diseases a child can ever have, because if something were to rupture inside of her, she wouldn't be able to tell you. The little girl was outside playing and she cut her leg and was bleeding and didn't know it and almost bled out. So I put the document on pause and I started to think about all of the pain that was in my life. And I realized that pain is actually good for you. It's actually an indicator that something is wrong. Pain is an indicator that the boundaries that were placed in our life to protect us have been removed. And pain is often an indicator that we've gone too far. So we actually need pain in order to live. And so I started thinking about all the painful moments that I had. And I'm like, wow, I cannot waste this. Like, this is good stuff. This is good pain. Pain is good for me. And regardless if it was pain that I didn't ask for, a lot of the things that happened to me, obviously, I didn't ask for. But I'm not going to waste that moment because it was meant to tell me something about me. When the little girl couldn't feel pain, unlike us, if we had pain in our lower back, we'll go to the doctor and they'll say you have kidney infection. That pain was meant to tell a story about your life and what was going on in it. And so I realized that I wanted to take all of the painful stories and I didn't want to waste an ounce of it because I don't believe that God wastes anything. And so Pain Not Wasted, it was very significant to me in making sure that I use everything that hurt me for a purpose.
Wow. Again, I'm thinking about the little young lady who's impervious to feeling pain and how, you know, that's really trapping her development, because if she can't respond to the things that she needs to respond to that hurt her, wow, you're talking about bleeding out. Something I learned and my life's journey is one of the benefits of pain, and I love that you talked on it being an alert system, but if you can't feel pain, you also don't understand joy.
Right.
You know, so I love that, you know, you're taking what most people would bury and just spend years of distancing themselves from, and you're using it to help others, again, find a bridge to a new place of joy, a new place of living life. Now, I want to read an excerpt from your book, and thanks for sharing this.
Excellent.
It says, I spent 2 hours in the gym today. Then I went into the steam room, and I just cried and cried and cried. I cried because I missed my brother who committed suicide in 2017. I cried because earlier this year, one of the youth at my church was killed. I cried because a couple months ago, another one of the youths at my church committed suicide. I cried because I can't love my drug-addicted father the way I want to. I cried because my mother is moving out of state next year, and I won't be able to build a relationship with her like I want to. I cried because this season that God has me in is productive, but very lonely. I cried because for years, I thought crying made you a weak or sad person. I cried because it's okay to cry. I have learned that tears are cleansing. They have a way of releasing pain so that it doesn't get trapped inside of us. God gave us tears for a reason, and I plan to use them beautifully to heal parts of my soul you may never see. Hashtag pain not wasted. Take us through that moment. Take us through that day.
I remember being at the gym and getting a really good workout in and feeling great right after I got done working out, that rush of serotonin coming in and everything was great. And I just remember thinking to myself, I feel sad. And I thought, I'm not supposed to feel sad. I just got through working out. I can't feel sad, because that's what we tell ourselves. You're not allowed to feel sad. You're not allowed to feel sad in this moment. You're not allowed to feel sad in that moment. Hold it back. You're okay. And I got into the steam room, and I think I figured because I was sweating so much that it may mask my tears, that I just started crying and crying. And I wanted to make sure that I got every tear out, because I knew that I wanted to feel everything that I felt. I feel like you have to let pain purge through you. Otherwise, it'll get trapped inside. And so I decided to let all of that out. And when I got home that night, I actually did not know why I was crying when I was in the steam room at that moment. I just knew I was sad. And when I got home that night, I reflected, like, why are you sad? Why are you crying? And so I just wrote it out, started writing all the things that made me sad and all the things that made me sad that I wasn't able to allow myself to feel when it happened. You know, my dad's been on drugs for years. I should have been able to cry for him anytime I felt hurt. My mother told me a long time ago that she was moving out of state. I should have been able to be sad about it then, but I realized that I had bottled it all up, and then that moment released it. And I felt like that was the best thing I could have ever done.
Wow. Wow. Pain not wasted. Powerful concept. And I know that it's going to be life-changing to the many who will be impacted by your work. You know just the ins and outs of both depression and anxiety from when it showed up in your life. Now, you shared about your brother. I'd love for you to take us through your personal struggles with depression and anxiety.
Yeah, for sure. Mine, like I said, the pivotal point for me was losing my brother. I had moments of deep sadness before in my life, you know, dealing with a lot of the tragedies that I had. But it wasn't until I lost my best friend that depression and anxiety really started to hit me. February of last year, I was in my bed sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up and I sat up in bed, and it was hard for me to breathe. And when I was younger, I suffered from asthma. So I thought, maybe I'm having just, you know, breathing issue with my asthma. I sat up in the bed and I was like, man, my chest is getting tight. And I started panicking. I said, oh my God, I feel like I'm having a heart attack. And my breathing started getting labored and more labored. And I rushed downstairs. My aunt was living with me at the moment, and I was taking care of her. She was disabled. And I just remember saying, oh my God, I'm having a heart attack. Like, you got to call 911. And she woke up and she called 911. And I remember sitting in her wheelchair next to her crying. And then I started to cry out to God. And I was just like, please, God, I don't want to die like this. Like, I don't want to die like this. And so I really thought I was dying. I really thought that I was having a heart attack. My breathing was getting more and more labored. And the paramedics showed up, and they got there and they took my blood pressure, and it was super high. And they said, okay, we're gonna take her in. And so I just remember being in the back of the ambulance thinking, I'm going to die. But I felt safer when I got in with the ambulance. I started to feel like I was calming down. So when I went to the hospital, to the emergency room, they ran a bunch of tests, you know, EKG and this and that and labs. And I was there for about an hour, and the doctor came in and said, everything's fine. Mm-hmm. All your vitals are fine. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way everything's fine. I think I was having a heart attack. And she goes, no, you're fine. So when they released me, I thought, oh wow, God saved me. You know, I was getting ready to have a heart attack and God saved me. Wow, this is great. So when I got home, it was actually Easter morning. I went to church and I said, okay, God, obviously you were trying to tell me something because I almost died and you saved me. I still had no idea that it was anxiety at this time. And I just remember 2 weeks later, the same thing happened and it happened worse. And I went to the doctor, ER, they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. A week later, it happened again. I was in my car driving and I couldn't breathe. And so I went to urgent care and they said, you know what? I think you should go to the ER. We don't really know what's going on with you. So I went to the ER and that time I just sat in the car with my best friend. My best friend Blake had picked me up and he said, are you going to go into the ER? And I said, no. I sat in the car and I looked out the window and I started crying. And I just, in that moment, I thought, I'm going to end up just like my brother.
Oh, wow.
This is it for me. This is what he was going through. He started losing his mind and slowly but surely, he just went down, down. And that's what's happening to me. The doctors can't fix me. No one can fix me. I don't want to go inside the ER. They keep telling me they don't know what's wrong. This is it. This is how I'm going to always be. And I remember just crying. And then I just went numb. I was just like, I didn't want to feel anything. I started just thinking to myself, I'm going to end up dying. I'm going to probably end up committing suicide because I'm going to start losing my mind soon. The lies that the enemy was starting to tell me, because as soon as you crack that door open just a little bit and he gets his foot in, you know, it's a wrap. And so I remember my friend begging me to go to the hospital the next week. And I went and they said, we think you're suffering from anxiety. Mm. And I thought, what the heck? Anxiety? Do you know how many things I've been through in my life? I've been through rape. I've had boyfriends punch me in my face. Mm. One of my boyfriends committed suicide. I had another boyfriend that I ended up having to stab to get him off of me. Ma'am, do you know what I've been through in my life? I've never had anxiety. I've always been able to handle it and deal with it and just suck it up. Like, what do you mean? I used to tell my friends I was a tow truck. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, the job of a tow truck was to carry the weight of other vehicles. And I don't know, but you've probably never seen a tow truck being towed ever, because the tow truck's job is to carry the weight of broken cars. Mm. The tow truck should never break down. And so that's what I was. I was a tow truck. And God forbid if I broke down, who was going to carry me? It would have had to been another tow truck. And of course, I didn't know anybody stronger than me. So I was literally going through my life carrying the weight of other broken people my whole life. So when she told me that I had anxiety, I was like, okay.
Wow.
And so I left the hospital feeling defeated because you don't know me. You don't know what I'm able to carry. I've been carrying cars my whole life. And so a couple of nights later, I was helping my aunt pack. We were moving. And I just remember being upstairs trying to pack and act like everything was okay. And I just broke down. And so I was sitting in this room by myself. I slid down the wall and I'm just sobbing. And I remember saying, okay, I need help. Somebody has to help me. This cannot be the end of me. And I just started frantically dialing numbers, Googling anxiety, depression, help, resources, hospitals, just everything. And I called the first number and they couldn't help me. And I called the second number and they were asking me a bunch of questions. And I was too emotional and too anxious to even answer them. It took me about four to six phone calls before I actually got somebody on the line that cared enough to make sure I didn't hang up. And to this day, I'm always thankful for her because I don't even want to know what would have happened if I would have gave up on the third, you know, phone call. Yeah, so I called and she said, you know what, I think there's a place that can help you. There's a hospital that's really good. They have great care. They'll be able to, you know, tell you what's wrong. And I thought, oh my God, thank you, God. And she gave me the number and I called and they said, yeah, we have a bed available. And, you know, coming from even a medical background, I really had never known what a psych hospital was. I never experienced it. So I actually thought I was going to a regular hospital. And that there were just going to be doctors there that kept an eye on me, you know, check my vitals. I would be able to talk to maybe a counselor. So I literally actually had no idea that I was checking myself into a psych hospital. But it ended up being the worst time of my life, but also the biggest blessing of my life. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. I want to rewind just a bit, because one of the things that really flashes out to me was the phone calls you had to make. And you shared that if you stopped on call number 3, we don't want to know what would have happened. And I think that is worth really going deep on, because how many people would have stopped on call number 2, number 1, much less get to 3, or much less keep going to 6?
Yeah.
What would you say to people in those moments of panic, anxiety, major depression, and they are calling one of the hotlines or calling for help, and maybe they're not getting the answers they need? What would you say to them?
Man, it's scary, actually, to even think about that. To be honest, I remember listening to a phone call of one of the teenagers that was a shooter at a school shooting. And I remember them playing the phone call back in the news of him calling several times down to the police department asking for help, and nobody could help him. And I remember that eerie feeling of knowing, you know, I remember that. I remember calling and asking for help and not getting it. And I would just say to those people to not give up. And that's another reason why I'm doing what I'm doing and preparing the resources that I have, because a lot of people don't know who to call or where to go or where the resources are. But I want you to know that you're not alone, that there are people that are in pain and are having dark moments and they don't know what to do. One, my faith with God was, wow. Honestly, my life is hard with God. I can't imagine what people's life is like without him. I'll just be very, very clear on that. Being able to hold on to something hopeful, I would say stop in that moment and think about the people that love you. Think about your goals and your dreams and the things that a moment in your life where you were actually happy, and try and hold on to that. But also, most importantly, if you can't get a hold of someone on the phone, tell someone that you love. Tell someone that you trust. Tell anybody. I know there's some people that don't even have family, that don't have close friends. I don't care if you stop someone on the street, you know, talk to someone and tell them how you're feeling. I know that we live in a country where we feel like a lot of people are very hateful and mean, but you'll be surprised at how many loving strangers you'll come across. Just being able to tell them, like, I really need help, or can you pray for me? Or just being able to express to someone that you're feeling really anxious or depressed and you don't know what to do in those moments. It's really case by case. You never know the level that someone's at or the torment that someone feels in those moments. So it's really hard to pinpoint, you know, specifically for each person.
Yeah. I love that you shared about how your faith helps stabilize your life and how Absolutely. Faith is a key to moving forward. And I don't want to, you know, gloss over that at all. Now, before lots of the, I'd say, trauma, major anxiety, major go-throughs, were you a person of faith, or was it something that you knew about but didn't participate in?
Oh, my family grew up Jehovah's Witness. We were Jehovah's Witness. So my parents got a choice of that year, what church we wanted to go to. And because of the amount of trauma I had in my life, I always held on to God. I always remember from just a small age of sitting in my room on my bed, crying and talking to God. I didn't have that very many friends when I was younger because I was like a quote unquote nerd. I was really into reading in school. So I didn't have that many friends, and I had a lot of brothers. My oldest sister, who's the only sister that I have, had moved out of the house when I was very young. So it was really just me and God a lot. And when my parents got divorced, I chose to continue to go to church. And although I didn't understand his word the way I do now, I didn't understand the Bible. I didn't understand any of that. I just knew that there was a God that loved me, and that anytime something happened to me, he would be there. That was my basic understanding of God, that he loved me, that he was there. And even now today, as an adult with understanding his word and applying the word, that small, simple principle is what I still hold on to, that he loves me and he's there. So yeah.
That's big. Now, And I say faith versus fear because, you know, a lot of the what ifs and a lot of the this could happen, you know, really can trigger anxiety, can trigger bouts of depression versus faith where there is this better way, you know, and things are going to work out. So when I say faith versus fear, what does that mean to you?
That's actually the perfect description of my 4-day stay at the psych hospital. That's actually the perfect comparison because faith is not in your circumstances. Faith is something that you have. It's in God. I believe that He is going to be with me no matter what my immediate surroundings look like. And so fear tells you that what your immediate surroundings look like is truth. And so fear is just a lie, my brother Striver used to say, that's running out of breath. It's starting to keep going around and around in your head. It's running out of breath. And so it's settling in as fear, but it's a lie. And so when I was in this hospital, I was scared. I had no idea what was going to happen to me. But faith told me that no matter where you are and what your circumstances look like, you're going to be okay. And so that was the difference of me, was my immediate surroundings. The lie was, you're not going to make it out of here. You're probably going to die here. This is where you're always going to be. That was fear. And faith was, no matter where you are and no matter what's around you, I'm with you. So there was both, a lot of both.
Wow. Wow. Now, you broke down a bit of your brother's mantra, and I think there's this wonderful photograph of your brother on your Instagram page, and that's What Najah Did in Heels. That's WhatNajahDidinHeels. So make sure you go connect with Najah Alesi and really, you know, share some feedback on some of the takeaways from this two-part conversation. Talk about your own journey through depression, through dealing with anxiety, or dealing with amazing moments of loss or some traumatic or tragic events. When you are speaking and connecting with Najah, understand that not only is she an expert because of her experience, she also put in the hours of research to learn how to not need medicine to truly walk back to a pathway to health. And, you know, before I ask you a bit about that, I wanted to just talk about what it means to keep the light that was your brother's life alive. And what does that strive harder mantra continue to mean to you today?
Listen, every single time I get into a moment of being mediocre, that's really when I hear that mantra, because it was really meant for you being able to do things abundantly and with excellence. And so there's a lot of times where people were talented and they would use their talents and gifts. My brother really believed in me. He would sit back in awe and say, you're so smart and you're so talented. But do you believe that about you? Like, I don't think that you're doing as much as you could be doing. I don't think that you're pushing as hard as you could be pushing. So for me, everything that I do in my life now, I like to measure it with, am I doing this with a level of excellence that Striver would have been proud of? And so I don't just do things to do them. I'm very intentional about when I speak and when I write and the projects that I hop on, the people that I connect with, the people that I love on. I'm very intentional because I want to make sure that I'm doing it with a level of excellence. And I want to, he used to say, don't just strive harder. So even if I'm striving towards something, I have to make sure that I'm doing it with, you know, vigorously and making sure that I'm also doing it with integrity. So it means a lot to me, and it definitely carries in my spirit on a daily basis.
Right. Man, I'm again just staring at this picture of your brother sitting there with, you know, well-dressed, handsome young gentleman, you know, hat on his lap, and just listen to all your love for him and who he was. I think, you know, as people connect with you and sharing your celebration of life, and even when it's transitioned in a way we don't understand, the light it leaves in the world, And I think as people connect with you, they'll feel that light as well. You know, I just want to give people a preview to part two, because we're going to, you know, talk deeper on what do you know about panic attacks, yeah, anxiety attacks. You know, we're going to talk about the science of things. We're going to talk about, you know, our journey to nutrition and health. You know, I found out that you're a vegan and so am I. So that's exciting. We can maybe share some light on, you know, how important food is in terms of our mental health and our self-care and our wellness. And, you know, what I love is that you're going to bring to light what the research shows about not just are we getting better as a country from taking anxiety medication, but, you know, for so many of us, we are aware of the opioid crisis, but we don't understand how maybe anxiety and depression plays into that, you know?
Right.
So absolutely. Just to have you be able to, you know, talk about your expertise there, I think people are going to not just want to tune into that, but to connect with you to really understand that there are ways to come back to a place of health without medication. I think that's going to free a lot of people to go on a different type of journey. One of the things I heard you say in an interview that was very powerful, you said one of the side effects of many antidepressant medicines is depression. You're like, what?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. Any other facts that maybe listeners need to understand, like right now, about why this is such an important conversation to be having right now?
This is so important because we have a whole new generation of young people. And I would hate to be a teenager right now because there's so many different pressures. The amount of pressure to be perfect on social media, the amount of pressure to have perfect grades in college, the amount of pressure to have great friends. You have so many pressures in the world, and especially in Western countries, especially like America, where we have this quote-unquote American dream that we want to live up to. It breeds depression and anxiety. And so when I was in the psych hospital for 4 days, I just remember the first day being like a whirlwind. Everything that happened in there, and I'll get into this story in detail on our next part, everything that happened in the psych hospital was counterproductive to healing. And by the second day, the first 2 days, I was very sick, so sick that I couldn't really comprehend what was going on. I just knew there was a bunch of chaos. But by the third day, God had given me a really, really, really good level of peace to where I was actually asking questions and paying attention to everything that was happening in there. And when I got out, I turned into a football coach. I was like, okay, what's the best way to beat your opponent is to study them. And so I said, depression and anxiety is my opponent. I am not going to let it beat me. I have to study it. And so that's where me becoming a depression and anxiety researcher came from, because depression and anxiety became my opponent. And the only way you can beat someone in any sport is to study what they're good at. So you had to study where depression came from, anxiety comes from, how it's good at eating people up. And then you can learn, okay, do they have a strong left hook or a right hook? How can I go in here and beat this? And so after my, you know, horrific experience at the hospital, I realized that I was going to have to do the work to get better, that the hospitals had it wrong, that a lot of doctors had it wrong. I don't want to say all, but a lot of doctors had it wrong. A lot of the numbers that I was calling prior to that had it wrong. And sitting back and analyzing so much brokenness in our mental health system, I had a choice. I can complain about it, or I can research it and find resources and tools to try and help someone else. So my end goal was, I'm going to use my pain. I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to use my pain to help others so they don't have to go through this. I don't want anybody having to dial 6 numbers. I don't want anybody checking themselves into a hospital to get healing and coming out worse. So my goal was to, you know, like I said, I went through the fire so that I'm hoping a lot of other people don't have to. And I lost someone through suicide. And if you've ever lost a loved one in any horrific way, whether it be a car accident or to an illness, you know how that feels. You always want to try and keep someone else from having to experience that amount of pain. So that's what we're going to do We are going to build a community where we hold each other responsible and accountable for our lifestyle. Your life, the way that you live, is the key to getting rid of depression and anxiety. So that's what we're going to get into.
Wow. Now I'll share this and then I'll let you tell everyone how to connect with you and what to think about as they prepare for part two. Now, one of the posts I really enjoy on your IG, and I never read the caption till today, and it's powerful. It says, "So after you have suffered a little while, he will restore, support, and strengthen you, and he will place you on a firm foundation. All power to him forever. Amen." And that's found in 1 Peter 5:10 through 11. And then after that, you write, "There is an after to your suffering. Don't get so comfortable in pity that you forget that you are powerful." And your post says, "You can't be pitiful and powerful." So I'd love for you to talk about that a bit, and I'd love for you to close us out.
Yes, absolutely. The first part of that cut off. I'm sorry. The first part of that cut out when you were talking. But you said go into the post of being pitiful and powerful.
Yep.
Yes, that I want people to know that there is an after to your suffering when you don't give up, that you will not always be in that place, and that God has put you in a position to where you can use your pain and turn it into power, but you cannot be both pitiful and powerful. You cannot sit and pity yourself and feel like, you know, you can't do anything for yourself and no one cares about you. You have to know that God has given you in you. Even with my brother, I feel like he had a choice. And regardless of what choice anyone chooses, I feel like you have to love them, you know, anyway. For me, I just think that being able to let people know that if you choose to use your pain for something powerful, you're not only going to save yourself, but you're going to save so many other people that are experiencing what you're experiencing. You're not the only one. People need your story. They need you. And it's going to be something beautiful that's made out of that pain if you allow it.
Wow. I think we all needed this conversation. Thank you again for just allowing us to connect, allowing us to dialogue over something people tend to avoid, but we know better. To the listeners, in part two, and I don't want you to think this is it. This was so much relevant and timely content. We could talk celebrities who have recently, you know, lost their fight to these moments of anxiety and depression. We can talk suicides at every level and how that impacts communities and families forever. And in part two, we're going to talk the tools. And I love that, you know, you put together so much in terms of a playbook and a plan. And this was, as you mentioned, from just doing the research, knowing what you didn't want to live with and feel like. I don't want to be on meds for the rest of my life. I want to know my enemy and understand, as you mentioned, what is the best strategy to move forward. And I know that people need exactly what you have. Again, thank you for just your passion to make us all aware that there is a way ahead. And what I am super excited about is, you know, in part two, we will have the tools and strategies that you use to continue to thrive. And we get to talk about your grandfather, who is a veteran. So I think that's going to be a treat for a lot of my veteran listeners who I know tune in to connect around stories that come from the veterans community.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bernard, for having me on. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to part two for sure.
You're welcome. And you have a great evening and part two in a few.
Thank you. Bye.
Are you proving them right or are you proving them wrong? I mean, we all have haters. We all have doubters, naysayers, people who just don't believe we're capable of doing what we said that we were gonna do. It's your job to prove them wrong. Not because their opinion matters, because you still call to do exactly what wakes you up at night, what keeps you up at night. that's never going to change. So no matter who doubts you, no matter who's not in your corner, no matter who's not standing beside you as you face obstacle after obstacle, it's your job to prove everyone wrong. And the first person you need to prove it to is yourself.
Thanks for listening to the Bernard Bergen Podcast. Leave a comment with two things you learned and one challenge to the information. Like and share this episode, and feel free to recommend topics we should cover on the podcast.